listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Wisconsin writer is back from base camp at Mount Everest. He'll share the story of the first all-black American team to reach the top of the legendary mountain. First, when you get invited to a party, how early do you show up or how late? If you get there right when it starts, you might be the first one there. The host might not even be ready. If you're too late, it might seem insulting or you might miss the fun. Our guest today used his mathematics PhD from MIT to come up with a calculus formula to help us find the ideal time to arrive at any party. It was published in a piece for The Atlantic. Daniel Biss is a former math professor at the University of Chicago. He's also a former Illinois State Representative and Senator, currently mayor of Evanston, Illinois. Daniel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rob.
All right, before I get to the formula, if I was to invite you to my house this weekend, say for a cookout, or whenabouts do you show up if I say it's at noon?
You know, the problem with writing this formula is now for the rest of my life, I have no excuse to show up to anything at the wrong time. I think, though, if you were to invite me over for a barbecue at noon, I would probably in real life shoot for arriving around 12:35.
That sounds about right. Okay. Now, Joe Pinsker from The Atlantic got in touch with you with this question. Can you mathify that decision of how early or how late to arrive? How do you mathematically, how did you get started on that?
Well, you know, I mean, first of all, like, let's be real for a second. The answer to the question is no. You can't mathify it in the way that I would recommend adhering to religiously in real life. But I just thought about, you know, what are the questions that you want to ask yourself when deciding when to show up? And some of that is, you know, do your friends tend to be on time? Some of that is, how reliable are your friends, right? Like, maybe your friends are really late. They always show up an hour late, but they always show up exactly an hour late. Whereas my friends might be more on time. On average, they're only 15 minutes late, but you never know. One day they might be right on the button on time, and the next day they might be 2 hours late. So questions like that, how predictable are other people's behavior come into play? And then, of course, there's your own taste. Do you feel real awkward if you're there too early? Do you feel really rude or like you missed out if you're there too late? And you kind of jumble all those things together in a big formula. And we came up with an answer that may not be perfect, but it's probably as good as any.
Yeah. And now you show your work. You've got the mathematical formulas there. I don't think we need to recite them on air. But you have this, there's a thing where there's sliders and you could say how important to you are those factors you just mentioned and then calculate. Now, I should show up 58 minutes late. Then after that, it feels late to me. I don't know. How do you judge that? How do you figure out how late is too late, even if the math tells us it's right?
Well, you know, it's like any other real world experiment. If you run the numbers and you show up and you're dissatisfied, then you probably should do something different next time. I think the most important thing in real life is, are you the kind of person who can't stand being late? Or are you the kind of person who can't stand being too early, right? Are you an extrovert who really is fired up for the party? And if you're there, you know, while the host is still in the kitchen preparing stuff and you're just there for a one-on-one conversation, kind of helping make the guacamole, that's terrific because you just want to be around people. Or are you the kind of person who finds that agonizing? And, you know, probably at the end of the day, that's the thing that matters most to most people is just, what am I looking to get out of this experience?
Now, I know when you went in with the math, obviously this is not a super serious real world problem, but is it fun for you as a mathematician to try to figure out, like, okay, if I was to try to solve this mathematically, how would I do it? Is this a fun way for you to play with math?
It is a fun way. And I think for all of the mountains of grains of salt that you want to take this with, there was something useful in the exercise, right? Because again, in real life, when I go to a party or any social function, I just kind of go. I don't put a lot of thought into how to decide when to leave my house. And by the way, I get it wrong a lot of the time because I don't put enough thought into it. And so one thing that was kind of cool about this project was by creating a formula, even if the formula isn't necessarily going to be accurate enough to put a person on the moon, I was able to kind of go through the exercise of thinking, well, hold on, what are the different factors I ought to consider? What questions should I ask myself before deciding when to leave? And I did find that not only kind of fun, but also actually a little bit useful just in and making plans in the real world.
Now, this isn't the first time you've put math to work on a social question. You helped author John Green with the formula for his book, An Abundance of Catherines, that used math to determine how potential romantic relationships could play out. What did that look like?
Yeah, I mean, I seem to have cornered the beat of making formulas about things you shouldn't make formulas about. So I'm not sure what that says about me. But yeah, John, this was his second novel called An Abundance of Catherines. And it was a really kind of funny, goofy premise. There was this child prodigy high school student who kept dating and getting dumped by girls called Catherine. And he was just sick of having his heart broken by Catherines. And so he wanted to develop a formula using all of his incredible talents that he could use the next time he met a Catherine to figure out if she would dump him or not, so that if the formula said she would dump him, then he could just not go out with her in the first place and avoid the heartache. And so, John asked me to kind of write a real formula. Again, understanding that it's a silly game. You should not enter into a romantic relationship based upon some formula in a young adult novel that came out 15 years ago. But you know, what would a formula like that look like? What variables would it take into account? What would it, you know, how would it be structured? And it was, you know, it was something that I had a lot of fun writing. And obviously John then became a, you know, hugely, hugely popular author. And so now there's people in the world that have that formula tattooed on their arms, and it's, it's a pretty amazing thing.
Now, getting back to the how late or early should I show up at the party, as a guest, I'm kind of in your range. I'll show up kind of late, not crazy late. But as the host, it's like 5 minutes till the party's supposed to start and nobody's there. And I'm assuming that my so-called friends all hate me. Do you have that problem when you host the thing, that you have like you reverse your expectations that you would have had as a guest?
Here's the problem, Rob. I have both problems as a host because I am simultaneously not prepared and desperately hoping everyone's late and also convinced they hate me, which is, I think, much more about my own neuroses than any kind of mathematical formula. But
same.
I find that 5 minutes beforehand, I am hoping that there is the worst traffic imaginable because I am not prepared.
Daniel, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
That's Daniel Biss, mayor of Evanston, Illinois, former math professor at the University of Chicago, with us today exploring how to tackle some of life's problems with math formulas, including how early or late you should show up to a party. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Producer Mary Kate McCoy brings us a story about popular game show host Alan Ludden's Wisconsin roots.
Many know TV personality Alan Ludden for his days as the host of the popular game show Password, or for his marriage to the beloved actress Betty White. Perhaps lesser known is Ludden's Wisconsin roots. Writer Dean Robbins recently stumbled upon his Wisconsin connection during a weekend getaway to Mineral Point.
I recently visited Mineral Point to sample its famous attractions, including the historic mining sites and the 19th century architecture. But during my stay in southwestern Wisconsin, I also stumbled onto a bit of local lore I'd known nothing about. I overheard several conversations about Alan Ludden, the smooth-talking TV game show host of the 1960s and 70s.
Now, here's your host on Password, Alan Ludden.
Wow, thank you. Welcome to a special edition of...
And at the Red Rooster Cafe, the small town's popular breakfast spot, my placemat listed Ludden's grave as a Mineral Point highlight. Many tourists might have said, and continued visiting the art galleries on High Street, but not me. I grew up with Ludden's Password, in which contestants traded clues to guess a mystery word. As an elementary school bookworm, I was drawn to a game show host who glorified the English language. We even wore identical horn-rimmed glasses, which made him look dashingly brainy and made me look like the last one you'd pick for dodgeball. While my friends watched cowboy shows, I kept the dial tuned to Password and, no surprise, grew up to be a writer rather than a ranch hand. I'd never thought about it before, but some of the credit goes to Alan Ludden. After a hearty breakfast at the Red Rooster, I searched the internet to explore Ludden's Mineral Point connection. He was born there in 1917, and his father, an ice dealer, soon died of the Spanish flu. When Alan was five, his mother married the guy who ran Mineral Point's electrical plant, after which the family moved around Wisconsin. Alan graduated Phi Beta Kappa from the University of Texas and then earned a master's in English, suggesting that his intellectual image was not just an act. After receiving a Bronze Star in World War II, Ludden hosted radio and television shows and found his star vehicle at Password in 1961. That's also where he met fellow TV personality Betty White.
Why, Betty White.
Why, Alan Ludden.
Well, it's nice to see you again.
Nice to see you.
What are your plans for the summer, Miss White?
Oh, dear.
They fell deeply in love, married, and worked together on stage and screen until Alan's death from cancer in 1981. White never remarried, saying, "Once you've had the best, who needs the rest?" Ludden was laid to rest in Mineral Point, and townsfolk speculated that his beloved Betty might be buried beside him. To their dismay, she chose not to join him for eternity in Wisconsin, though she did donate his papers to the Mineral Point Library before her own death in 2021. My Alan Ludden journey ended with a pilgrimage to his gravesite on the western edge of town. To its credit, Graceland Cemetery gives no special treatment to Mineral Point's famous son. So, in the absence of signage, I wandered for a while through the sloping grounds. Finally, I found the tombstone, which mentions Alan's service in World War II, but nothing of his showbiz career. Indeed, the peaceful plot feels as far from his star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame as you can imagine, bordered by the Iowa County Fairgrounds and rolling farmers' fields. I couldn't help thinking that Betty White might have been quite comfortable there.
Children's author and journalist Dean Robbins brought you that story about the popular game show host Alan Ludden's Wisconsin roots. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, history was made when an all-black team of American climbers summited Mount Everest last month. An outdoor enthusiast and journalist was there at base camp. He walks us through the experience. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A team of climbers made history as they became the first all-black American team to reach the summit of Mount Everest in May of this year. Prior to their trip, fewer than 10 black people had climbed Mount Everest since the first confirmed ascent in 1953. The team, as part of the Full Circle Everest expedition, just about doubled that number. James Mills, a Wisconsin-based writer and author of the book The Adventure Gap, Changing the Face of the Outdoors. He's co-writer and co-producer of the documentary film An American Ascent and founder of the online news site The Joy Trip Project. James works as a journalist and still photographer for the Full Circle Everest expedition and made it to Everest base camp with the team. James, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, Rob. Thanks a lot for having me. It's good to talk to you again.
Can you tell us a little more about why this is a historic and significant expedition?
Well, I think you said it yourself in your introduction. This is basically a doubling of the number of black climbers that have made it to the summit of Everest. But it's also important to point out that this was the first all-black American team mm-hmm. to summit Everest. And in the process, we actually managed to put the very first black man on the summit. A black American man on the summit of Everest. Prior to this expedition, that had never happened before.
Tell us about the origins of the Full Circle Everest expedition.
Well, I think that we've been working on figuring out how to do something like this for a number of years. My book, The Adventure Gap, talked about the first all African American team to attempt the summit of Denali, the highest peak in North America in 2014. And in doing so, we were trying to engage and inspire a new generation of particularly young people of color to venture into things like high altitude mountaineering. And over the course of the time since, we've actually been able to get quite a few new climbers coming into the field. And especially with the incidents around 2020, with the death of George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, and Breonna Taylor, it was an opportunity for us to put together a very positive story of Black excellence that would hopefully do as we've always tried, and that's to encourage more people who are underrepresented in certain aspects of our society to reach to the highest heights. And what higher height is there than the summit of Mount Everest? And so with the support of a lot of really great companies in the outdoor industry, as well as a lot of private organizations and nonprofits, a group of climbers led by Philip Henderson, who is a former instructor with the National Outdoor Leadership School based in Colorado, got together as many of the people in the African-American community that have taken up climbing over the last many years. And this team came together, a total of two women and eight men, a team of 10, to do the summit attempt. And seven of those 10 climbers made it to the summit.
Can you paint us a picture of what it's like to be at base camp for an attempt at Mount Everest?
Well, I mean, first of all, the walk in is in itself an adventure, mm-hmm. just in the sense that you're walking through the Khumbu Valley, and it is a very steep uphill climb over the course of almost 2 weeks, just getting into position to be able to set up base camp at the elevation of 17,600 plus feet. Once you arrive there, there is basically a tent city. I mean, there are many other expeditions going on at the same time, as well as several scientific expeditions that are installing weather forecasting equipment. And everybody is there essentially to have a experience on the highest mountain in the world. Now, not everybody who makes it to Everest Base Camp actually is interested in ascending to the summit. A lot of people go just to get that far. And the number of people that we met along the way is actually pretty remarkable. People literally from all over the world, from every continent, every nation, shows up at Everest Base Camp to celebrate mountaineering as part of an expedition tradition.
Now, you and the team have been very careful to acknowledge the Sherpa people and the guides you worked with, who haven't always gotten credit in the history of Everest mountaineering. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, and that's the interesting thing too, because I mean, a lot of people can name Sir Edmund Hillary as the first European to make it to the summit of Mount Everest, but not very many people know the name of Tenzing Norgay, who was right alongside Hillary when he made it to the summit of Everest. By the same token, not very many people know that Jim Whittaker, the first American climber to make it to the summit of Mount Everest, was accompanied by a man by the name of Nawang Gambo. And that is, again, something that doesn't make it into our history. One of the things that was really important for the telling of this story was to acknowledge that there is no Everest expedition that happens without the cooperation, the support, and the physical labor of Nepali Sherpa people. And I can tell you that among our Sherpa team was a gentleman by the name of Amrit Ale, who grew up in the Khumbu Valley and was also a Knowles instructor. And this was his very first climb of Everest. This expedition that will also be made into a film encouraged and supported a four-time Everest summiter, but a first-time Everest photographer by the name of Pemba Sherpa. And many of the pictures that you'll see in many of the magazines of the team were taken by either Pemba or Amrit. And I think that it's really important that we not only talk about the role that Sherpa play in the long history of Everest, but the success of this expedition as a climb that was executed by people of color with the intention of inspiring people of color. We really had positive representation of both the Black American community and the Sherpa community as well.
Now, James, most of us won't end up climbing Mount Everest, but I know from having talked to you in the past, you're really hoping to encourage people who might not think of themselves as outdoor people or might not feel welcome because of their race in the outdoors. You're really hoping to encourage them and make a good world for them to do these kind of things in. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that you know, the purpose of my work, my book, The Adventure Gap, the work that I'm doing currently for National Geographic, with the exploration of a new book that I'm working on that explores Black history as interpreted by the National Park Service. I think it is really important to recognize that Black Americans, Black people have always played a role in outdoor recreation, have always played a role in the conservation and environmental movement. We need to make sure that that representation is reflected in the people that we see on expeditions, in our national parks, as not only visitors, but park rangers and guides and naturalists and scientists. And expeditions like this basically allows us to now thread a line that goes from the depths of the ocean to the heights of the tallest mountains. And so that people who are interested in this kind of thing can actually see people who look like them as part of the landscape of what outdoor recreation looks like. These are people who will be able to say, wow, that person comes from my neighborhood. That person comes from my community. They go to my church. They're just like me in many ways. That means that I could probably do something like that too. But they don't necessarily have to climb the highest mountain in the world, but they can go to Devil's Lake. You know, they can hike around, you know, Lake Wingra here in Madison, or visit the UW Arboretum, or have experiences in some of our nearby national parks and monuments, specifically the Ice Age National Scenic Hiking Trail, one of 11 scenic hiking trails in the United States.
And we'll have
one more opportunity.
We'll have to leave it there. James, thanks for joining us today. That was James Mills, writer and journalist, author of the book, The Adventure Gap, talking about the significance of the first all-Black American team summiting Mount Everest last month and his own experience with that group. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll check out the latest public hearing on the January 6th Capitol attack and the effort to overturn the 2020 elections. That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll talk to a Milwaukee-based bookfluencer about her Instagram account, Always Black, celebrating Black literature and nonfiction. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, an economist explains the Fed's big interest rate hike earlier today and the stock market's downturn in the last couple of weeks and what it means for you. First, our next guest is a Milwaukee bookfluencer. That's an influencer who writes about books. She shares her love of reading on the Instagram account Always Black, which she runs for Penguin Random House. Cree Miles celebrates Black literature, from classics like Toni Morrison and James Baldwin to new authors like Mateo Ascarapor. She hosts weekly Drop Everything and Read sessions with her followers, invites people to answer prompts like poorly explain your favorite book, and asks for the book equivalents of her favorite songs. And each week she shares a new word she grabbed from a book that she's reading and then writes a song about it. Here she is rapping about the word clandestine, which she got from the novel Cherish Farah by Bethany C. Morrow.
I just want to do a little quick artistic note and let y'all know that the word is clandestine. I will be pronouncing it a little differently throughout the song, but it's clandestine. I don't want y'all out here looking wild. Clandestine, done secretly, done privately, done covertly. You feel me? Clandestine. All right, let's go. C-L-A-N-D-E-S-T-I-N-E, done secretly, clandestine. And when you do it, can't nobody know about it. It's clandestine. You should unpack how you really feel about it. Clandestine. I don't have really much.
All right, we're going to have some fun with books, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite book written by a Black author or a favorite Black author? Are you reading anything good right now? What is on your list of books to read this summer? What kind of things do you look for good summertime reading? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Cree Miles is the curator of Penguin Random House's Instagram account, Always Black. She's also the creator of the Black Like We Never Left book club. Miles has been nominated for a Webby and won a Shorty Award, which honors work on the internet. Cree, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I am so happily embarrassed that you played that word of the week.
I love to happily embarrass people. It's what the show is all about, really. Can you tell us a little bit, if we go and check out Always Black on Instagram, what are we going to find there?
So as you mentioned, I do host weekly sessions dedicated to reading time for adults, and I'm constantly promoting the new books by Black authors that are coming out of Penguin Random House, and then just the niche stuff of the Black community, the Black reading community. I just put up a reel about it was a 9-second review of Beloved, and if you haven't read the book, you don't get it, but if you read the book, you get it, and you thought it was hilarious. So that type of stuff, you know.
Part of what's fun about this is, you know, we think of reading as a solitary activity, unless maybe you join a book club. It seems like you're building a community of people who love reading.
Yeah, I think that was really important to me, because, you know, my whole book influencer journey started after I read Bluest Eye and just needed people to talk about it with. And so now that there is just a community of dedicated people who love talking about books, I even through my travels, when I've had to link up with an influencer or an author and we go out for dinner, we literally just talk about books for 2 hours. And just to have a whole community of people where that's all you do is it's super fun.
Yeah, sometimes I think, you know, we might love kids' books when we're kids, and we grow out of it, or we go in stages of reading where we fall away from it as grownups. Can you help inspire, maybe rekindle that love of reading for us grownups?
Reading is so important to me, and I was just tweeting about this. I just feel like we're just in a pandemic of anti-intellectualism, and I think a lot of people think if you're only reading things of substance, if you're reading heavy nonfiction or nonfiction about real estate or et cetera, et cetera. But I think grownups especially forget that we live our lives in stories. And so to have a greater expanse of stories to pull from makes your brain stronger. So it makes you think better. I really believe that.
We're talking to Cree Miles, curator of the Instagram account Always Black. She, as you hear, is encouraging us to read, and she promotes Black authors and Black literature in particular. You could join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. If you want a recommendation, if you have a recommendation, 800-642-1234. Cree, according to the numbers, the publishing industry skews white. At Penguin Random House, where you're doing this Instagram account, 76% of the books they published between 2019 and 2021 by white authors. Can you talk about your goals to promote specifically Black authors, past and present?
Sure. I mean, I think I can speak for myself. When I started this journey, I was fairly confident that the Black canon had already been written. And now that I'm deep up to my neck in this work, I realize that it's being written real time right now. And there are phenomenal authors creating amazing work that everybody should know about. And I think the more Black authors that we get on shelves, it'll be even more impactful.
You sent us a list of some recommendations for the summer, and you've already spoiled one of them, Toni Morrison, The Bluest Eye. And this is, as you said, a book that really got you started down this path. Why was this such a game changer for you?
It really is what people say about you don't, a lot of times I know when I've talked to Black people, Black women, LGBTQIA folks, the things that we're given in school, you don't necessarily see yourself. And so you think the things that you experience are these really specific things that no one else is going through, which is why you don't even have language for the stuff. But after I read Bluest Eye, was the first time where I was okay, I'm not crazy. All of the things that I know I was experiencing was real. And it was even more sobering that the book, because I read this book 6 years ago, right? And it came out in 1970, I think. So the fact that it's still so relevant is just telling, it makes your experience more universal and less lonely. I think that's why it's important.
One of your missions in life, as I understand it, is to get people who don't think they're going to like Toni Morrison to try some Toni Morrison. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, you know, my whole thing is when people are listening to a phenomenal singer, like you're like, I can't listen to Freddie Mercury. He's too good. I can't listen. And it's like, I think people say that about the best writers too. And it's, yes, you can, just because they're really good. Part of the reason they're really good at their craft is because they make the complicated thing accessible. So you can totally enjoy Toni Morrison. You might have to slow down. You might have to engage you might have to engage your brain in a way that you usually don't, but that doesn't mean that you can't read and enjoy the book.
We heard from Kim on the Ideas Network Facebook page. It's Lot by Brian Washington was the first time I read a book by an African-American author and thought, this book was clearly not written for me as a Midwestern white person. Kim goes on, that sort of blew my mind in a good way. I'm sure I'm late to the game in realizing this, but it left me wondering how many authors of color or other cultures have knowingly or unconsciously changed the way they write in order to meet white culture expectations. Kim concludes, definitely was a worthwhile read for me in so many ways. Interesting comment, Cree. What do you think?
I mean, most authors that I read, like the goal is to not center the white gaze. That's all Toni Morrison talked about when she was writing, and she sometimes got chastised about it. Like, when are you going to stop writing about Black things? But I do think part of the point of diversifying our shelves is to show that no matter who the story is centering, a lot of human experiences are universal. So it doesn't have to be a white man for all of us to see ourselves. Everybody should also be able to see themselves in a little Black girl or a little Latina boy, because that is how we build empathy.
Let's get back to some of your summer reading suggestions. I'll let you go where you want. You've got some older ones on your list and some brand new stuff. Hit us with a couple.
Okay, so Real Life by Brandon Taylor, I read it a year late, and I know that he's writing a new book right now because I stalk all his socials and he turned in the manuscript. But he's wonderful, especially for this crowd, because the story actually takes place in a fictional collegiate town that is exemplified off of the University of Wisconsin, because he studied, I think it was chemistry there, until he got accepted into the Iowa's Writers Workshop. And so that's where he became a writer. And it takes place, it's my favorite type of novel. It's a campus novel. It takes place during one weekend. It centers a queer Black man. It's so masterful. Like, I can't even. And then the other one that I mentioned, the other backlist that I mentioned, On Beauty by Zadie Smith, is the book that I always recommend when people say that they want to read more, but they don't know where to start. Again, as I said, I am a sucker for a campus novel. This is also a campus novel. Zadie Smith is brilliant. I don't have another word for it, because she gives us this realistic fiction, campus novel, domestic fiction, but it's still highbrow. So it's just all about all of these interpersonal relationships and people working through the different family dynamics. She's really masterful at centering multiracial families. So she does that in On Beauty as well. And so the new releases that I mentioned, Shine Bright by Danielle Smith, it's four books behind me and I'm still obsessed. It's her very intimate portrait of Black women in pop. Danielle is a prominent music journalist. She was the editor-in-chief of Vibe. She worked at Billboard. She interviewed Whitney Houston. She's interviewed Janet Jackson, Mariah Carey, all of them. Oh my gosh, excuse my dog.
That's okay. We love dogs on the show.
But she talks about, she goes into deep detail about what it takes to create a pop hit, because the formula isn't as simple as a great song and a great voice. There's kissing babies. There's a lot of politics behind immortalizing a song. And then she just talks about the influence that Black women have had on the pop industry, and about arguments about why pop has kind of sometimes been considered not the most sophisticated genre, even though it should be up there with the rest of them. I was obsessed. And then she weaves in her personal story. She grew up in Oakland. She went to a school of the arts. It's really dope. Civil Rights Queen by Tamiko Brown Nagin. It centers Constance Baker Motley, who was the civil rights attorney in the 60s, who argued a lot of the cases that desegregated the higher institutions of learning in the South, like Ole Miss and University of Alabama, University of Georgia. And I do not understand why she is not a household name. So I'm pushing it out everywhere because Tomiko is a professor at Harvard and has done extensive research on Constance. And it was, I learned so much. Like, I learned things that I just feel like we should all know. So that's why I'm passing on the book. It's hefty. It's a hefty nonfiction, but it's totally worth it.
We're talking to Milwaukee. We'll pick up just a minute. We're talking to Milwaukee-based bookfluencer Cree Miles about her Instagram account, Always Black, which celebrates a Black literature and, as we're hearing, nonfiction as well. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a book or an author to share, something you want to ask about. What makes a good summertime read for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or join the conversation on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation about Black literature with Cree Miles from Milwaukee. She's the curator of Penguin Random House's Instagram account called Always Black. She's sharing recommendations with us, and you can too if you'd like, at 800-642-1234. We want to hear about books you love from Black authors, books you've maybe learned from or that made an impression on you. Or you can get a recommendation at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Hearing from more of you online than in person here, Tim on Facebook writes, suggests Homegoing by Ya Jossi. And Pete writes, Poppy, the autobiography by, baseball player David Ortiz. Cree, you were giving us some recommendations. Pick up where you left off.
First, I have to shout out Ya Jossi. True. I haven't read Homegoing, but I read her second one, Transcend the Kingdom, and 10 out of 10. She's brilliant. The last thing that was on my recommendation list was the only book that I haven't read on this list, but I know that it's going to be good because I've read every other book by the author. Okweke Emezi, You Made a Fool of Death with Your Beauty. They write everything, and this was their first romance novel. And so the fact that they write, like, highbrow literary books, and then also, like, I mean, the romance novel is getting a lot of buzz, so I think if there's any, like, everyone needs to pick that up. I haven't read it yet because it's not out of Penguin Random House, and I've kind of had to do all of that, but I'm picking it up at the end of this week. I'm super excited about it.
Now, I gotta ask you, you know, I read a lot for work, you know, prepare for interviews, and I read a lot for fun on my own time. Does it, since your job in part now is reading, does it make it less fun, or is it still enjoyable for you?
It's still amazing. You know, it is like when I had to read Civil Rights Queen, I felt like I was in school for a little bit. Like, it's this really thick nonfiction book. But then all of the things that I got out of the book, it was totally worth it. And then the other part is, like, this last week I was reading a romance novel. So, like, I get paid to do that. So it's super, it's all rewarding.
Excellent. Now, speaking of genres, say a particular radio host was a big science fiction and fantasy fan. Do you have any recommendations? So like, this is not controversial. N.K. Jemisin, I mean, she's won massive amounts of awards in the genre. I'll read her laundry list if she publishes it. You could talk about N.K. Jemisin or anybody else you might recommend.
Okay, first, I want to know, what is your favorite book by N.K. Jemisin?
Okay. So the Broken Earth trilogy there, a little heavier. Yeah. I liked a lot. That's like more serious. 100,000 Kingdoms, it's still like kind of dark in some ways. I had a lot more fun with that one. So maybe depending on my mood, you know?
You know, I've only read Fifth Season and I was obsessed, but I just haven't had a chance to go back. Oh. And I know that if you love sci-fi, then you know that N.K. Jemisin is running because Octavia Butler walked. Mm-hmm. But I feel like the one that a lot of people don't know about is Ursula K. Le Guin. And you have, like, my entry point for her always is The Word for World is Forest. And she's not a Black author. She's a white woman. She recently passed. She was elderly, I think, in like 2020 or 2019. But The Word for World is Forest is a really good entry point to me for her because it's short, but she is masterful. Like, I love, she got me out of my slump when I was in college. I picked up the discipline by her and was obsessed.
Left-Handed Darkness by Ursula Le Guin was, it's like, I mean, again, not controversial. Yes. It's on one of my all-time favorite lists as a science fiction fan.
Of course. Of course.
Cool. I got to join your book clubs and stuff. Seems like we're on the same page on some of this. So, Craig, you mentioned, you know, sometimes with any sort of literary canon, whatever we're talking about, we could think, oh, it's the stuff that was written back then. But you said earlier the Black literary canon is still, you know, it's a living thing. Could you talk about who you see kind of on the cutting edge of that?
Yeah. So one person who I'm always like, this is a hill I die on, that's not even like a controversial hill, is Robert Jones Jr. His debut novel, The Prophets, was shortlisted for the National Book Award, and it centers a queer love story that takes place in the antebellum South between two enslaved men in Mississippi. And when I talked to him about the book, I was like, why? And he said, because the canon needed it, so I wrote it. And it took him like 15 years to write it.
Wow.
But it's a masterpiece. So that one for sure. And like, anything by Akweke Emezi, and of course Ta-Nehisi Coates, and of course Zadie Smith. Like, I could, you know, I could go on and on and on.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Ed is with us in Duluth. Hi, Ed.
Hello. Hello, Cree.
Hi, Ed. And
thank you. Thank you for taking the call. Am I supposed to say something?
Yeah.
Now?
What did you want to bring up, Ed?
Well, when she was talking about her, you know, reading Black authors, I think one of the motivations for a lot of people is in line with lifestyles of the rich and famous, in the sense that we're interested, or the public seems to be interested, in people who are different from ourselves. Mm. And, you know, having lived abroad also and stuff, understanding Black culture and the experience, you know, reading books that really give you an insight into that is really invaluable, I think, for people who are like me, white, middle class.
And Ed, do you have specific authors you'd point toward?
Yes. James Baldwin, both his fiction and nonfiction, The Fire Next Time, Giovanni's Room, you know, there was a couple others. And then Langston Hughes is a poet. I like writing poetry. And Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man just knocked me off my feet.
Ed, thanks a lot for calling in. Cree, jump in on any of those.
Ed, honestly, I'm just, I love my job because I get to do things like this and talk to people like you, Ed, a white man in Duluth who is here celebrating James Baldwin. That literally, I was smiling ear to ear listening to you talk. That's wonderful.
Thank you so much for calling in and sharing that, Ed. Okay, what is on your stack right now, Cree? What is in arm's reach and you're going to read it maybe starting this week or weekend?
Okay, so it's super. I do a weekly talk with authors on Always Black, and I'm off for the next 2 weeks, so I get to read whatever I want. Ooh. And so I'm running to You Made a Fool of Death with Your Beauty by Akweke Emezi. And I think I'm going to start there. I'm trying to think, is there anything else that I feel like pressing that I need to get to? That's really the top of the priority list for me. Oh my goodness. I haven't read any Toni Morrison this year, and I try to read at least one novel a year. So I might tackle Paradise, maybe.
And you, I got to ask, are you a rereader? Every once in a while, I'll reread something. I usually don't.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I wasn't until I did my first readathon, and it was the Toni Morrison readathon. So I reread Beloved, and I was like, wow, I should definitely reread this more often. I'm thinking, because I would eventually like to write more. And so I think that I'm going to just like systematically reread my favorites, like just like reread Bluest Eye over and over again. I think I'm going to do something like that.
Excellent. Cree, thanks a lot for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you so much for having me. This was awesome.
Cree Miles is the curator of Penguin Random House's Instagram account, Always Black, which has won a Shorty Award and been nominated for a Webby. She joined us. She's from Milwaukee, by the way. I should re-mention that. She joined us to talk about Black literature. Lots of recommendations there. You can keep sharing yours over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, an economist explains Monday's big market drop, what it means for the economy and for you, plus today's news about a substantial increase in the interest rate coming from the Federal Reserve, the goal, try to slow down inflation. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.